This is episode one of the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast with Paul Gibbons and Adam Patanowicz. Welcome to the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan. I'm the president of Haku Global. This is a space for globally minded experts to dialogue about the future of leadership with a focus on the key question, how can leadership be more intelligent about futures? From their conversations, innovative wisdom, practical tools, and actionable insights emerge to help future-ready leaders thrive in an uncertain, complex, and exponentially changing world. Let's jump in to the dialogue. Aloha and welcome to today's episode. I'm joined by guests Paul Gibbons and Adam Patanowicz. Paul is a keynote speaker and specialist in leading change, business strategy, and helping businesses navigate ethical challenges. He's a professor at the University of Denver, and his current project is a four-book series called Leading Change in the Digital Age. He just released the second book in the series called Impact, which focuses on culture and mindset for digital transformation and the future of work. Interestingly, Paul and I share a background in graduate school studies in both biomedicine and philosophy. Adam is an innovator and researcher in technology, specifically in startups, financial, and biomedical industries. He draws on a variety of skills from engineering, computing, and machine learning to help solve problems. He's a seasoned startup executive and currently a lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa, and a faculty member at Singularity University. What I really like about this episode is it sets the tone for the Futures Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. We have two big thinkers discussing a variety of current and future leadership relevant issues that require us to expand the scope of our horizons and challenges leadership, as Paul says in the dialogue, to look beyond the next quarter and look into the next quarter century. If you're interested in agility and resilience and rapid change, upgraded cognition, signal-to-noise ratios, technology access gaps, and exploring the human competitive advantage, then you will enjoy this episode. Let's listen. So thank you, Paul and Adam, for joining me here on the Future Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. As always, I want to start with this key question of how does your work help to address this question of what does it mean for a leader to be intelligent or smart about the future, given uncertainty, complexity, and exponential change in the world? And I'd love for Paul, if you could start with that question.
It's such a big question. So first of all, there is no is future. So there's not a, I don't believe there's a future out there waiting for business leaders. And what we have to do with our time is figure out what that future is. And then we can, our predictive analytics aren't good enough for that. It's too complex. So I guess one non-answer to the question is you want an organization that's agile enough and responsive enough to be able to deal with contingencies, to rise to challenges, and to exploit opportunities. So I would say, you know, and this is a typical, like, you know, philosophy undergraduate sort of politician answer, is to duck the question, is that what we want to do is create an organization that has agile features. And so there's a whole lot to say about that, but I would like to stop for a minute and just, you know, briefly hear Adam's take.
Yeah, go ahead, Adam. What are your thoughts on it?
Thanks so much, Paul. And I think you raised something so important, and it's about a resilience to change. At the moment, we look to the future with some projections, some cone of uncertainty that means that our future is still to be determined. And the beautiful thing about the future is we play a massive role in creating that future. So I think we're kind of betwixt and between two conflicting ideas at the moment as leaders. The first is that on the one hand, we feel we are kind of passengers. We can't control this future that we're on, and we're going to be disrupted, disintermediated as a species perhaps. And we go very far in projecting into a future where we play very little role. And on the other hand, it strikes me that we are fully in control of our future. We're actually defining and building it. So one thing that's certain to me is that idea of change. And I think a resilience to change is going to be just about everything in this future world, because no matter which of those two roads we're on, we're certainly on a journey of change.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And you know, this idea of resilience and change. And I'm also interested in the difference between being like agile versus constantly changing and pivoting because you're forced to. And how do we be more proactively agile?
I use agile not in a way that refers to a specific way of managing projects and endeavor. I use it as a sort of in the much broader sense of the word, in that the organization is agile and responsive and mm-hmm. innovative. And so what does that mean? So we've known since in organizational theory, since the 40s and 50s, that organizations that are highly structured with rigid hierarchies and reporting lines and military type roles and responsibilities are very good at mass producing things, and they're very poor and resistant to change, structurally resistant to change. So there have been a lot of experiments with, and one of the most interesting ones is Holacracy, where everybody in the organization has an accountability for sensing the future. The purpose of the company, everything that happens and everything that's happening in the company in the XR world is tested against what's the purpose of the company. And when they sense, they have a special word for it, some sort of discontinuity or discomfort with something that's in the organization or some strategy that they're not following that they ought to be following, or they are following that they ought not to be following. So that's, I think, without embracing all of Holacracy, is something that we want to create as organizations, where everybody who has a stake in the future has some responsibility. And, you know, the people on the ground, they talk to customers day in and day out, you know, the people at the bottom of the organization. And so that's the, I think, one structural facet of agility is that you want to structure organizations so that ideas bubble up from the bottom without having to be cascaded down from, you know, the wise old men. And they usually are men still these days at the top.
Adam, do you have any insights on that too?
If we are, looking to outsource leadership to hire people in an organization, and if we're looking to get our leadership thinking and ideas from people who are not necessarily at the coalface, that's a very hard position to be in as a company that's looking to change, because there's not sufficient information flow in that organization. The one thing that comes to mind here is that whenever innovation seems to happen within an organization, it's not necessarily from the top, because everyone's kind of doing the usual things, but rather a completely sidelined curveball where someone has the space to innovate within their space in an organization, and they are able to run with something because they have the freedom to do so. So absolutely. I mean, I think that if ideas can bubble up from the bottom up, and there's the space to innovate, the space to think, the space to create, that is an organization that can potentially adapt and change.
Now, from your perspectives too, how well are companies doing within this idea?
You know, the digital transformation world, McKinsey, I admire them a great deal. I think their writing on business is, you know, really, really, really superb. And they have an unparalleled and unbettered network with the biggest and best companies in the world. One of the things that they said is that 80% of companies today are attempting some sort of digital transformation, and that only 25% are succeeding. So they have no reason to make that up. These are surveys. So what's happening with that? Well, if you're a chief executive of a company, you're in a really horrible place, because you either invest a lot of money with a 25% chance that you'll produce the sorts of returns that you wish, or you ignore it and you say, well, we're going to put our money elsewhere, but you miss the digital revolution that's happening around you. And so it's a pretty difficult space to be in, and I don't envy them that choice. So yes, what do you think about that, Adam?
I think people are falling into a bit of a trap where we're trying to change organizations and digitize them kind of entirely with the same structures and people and thinking. And that is a trap. I think no matter how much budget you throw into that, you're just going to keep doing the same thing you're doing perhaps with more resource, perhaps, you know, there won't be these types of radical transformations that we are seeking out these days that are creating massive scale digital businesses, unless there is some attention to the structure of that, how that fits into the organization. And I think that what naturally tends to happen when one tries to implement change in one's organization is there is an immunity that comes about in the organization that tries to disrupt the very change you're trying to create, because people start to get unsettled under conditions of change. And I would say that under those unsettled conditions of change, people then start to fight against the change inherently, and perhaps not necessarily consciously, or perhaps in some cases consciously, but that starts to impede change. And so that the very change that people are trying to bring about is defeated within the organization.
Let me ask a question, because it's something that I've thought a great deal about is what evidence do we have that change is necessarily upsetting for people? Like, that strikes me a sort of blanket statement. There are people who get excited and inspired and, you know, want to be part of something bigger and newer and faster and better. And so I don't think it's a necessary fact of humans that change is responded to in the some sort of, well, I've debunked this many times, like the Kubler-Ross denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance model. Or so that's that. And so that speaks a little bit to people's expectations. You know, we've been talking about change as if it's something different, as if it's something that doesn't happen day in and day out, and has been happening since the Phoenician sailors used to sail around the Mediterranean trading, you know, in their sort of these proto-businesses from 3,000 years ago. Change has been, and we say, oh, well, it's faster today. I am not convinced. My grandfather was born in 1900, and I think I say this in the book, but before his 25th birthday, he'd seen World War I, radio, television, the automobile, flight, the Titanic, the Spanish flu, all of that, you know, before his 20th birthday, in fact. So, and as a friend of mine said, who's a history buff, you know, if you'd seen Napoleon torching your fields, or if you were a Native American living in 1820s and 30s United States with cavalry coming over the hill, what's happening today and sort of change, you know, so we lack a sense of perspective. It's called the availability bias. We think that we're also special, and the time that we live in is particular and special and wonderful, and we're special and wonderful. And it's a seductive thing for consultants to say too, because consultants can say, ah, well, you know, this is a special time, and this is, you know, an opportunity to think, and change is faster than ever. And if you don't hire somebody like me, well, so anyway, I cast that out as a kind of a sort of challenge to orthodoxy. It's not something I'd want to stand behind 100%, but I do worry. Mm. What are your reactions, guys?
Yeah, I love that question, because that's one of the things that I've been definitely asking a lot of people is it really different right now? Does leadership need to be something different because of this idea, like you're saying, of rapid change being there? Is it just a perception we have? And I know in my background in medicine and also in business, is I know the one thing I know about change is it does elicit typically some type of physical, you know, physiological response. And it's how we perceive that physiological response determines, you know, whether we're going to embrace that change or resist it. Mm-hmm. Adam, what are your thoughts?
Well, you guys raise such interesting points, and specifically those examples are quite intriguing. I mean, I think that change is not necessarily bad, but I do think people respond to change based on their own situation, conditioning, etc. And I think the important thing that you may have mentioned or gestured towards is the idea that when change is happening, it's all about your expectations around it. And I think that's the key thing, is that if the whole organization, for instance, was able to change at a whim from leadership through the organization, and all of the processes and procedures in that big cybernetic organism consisting of both computers and human beings and human brains all together could move in one direction, I think then perhaps change would be as easy as an individual who is willing to accept change, for instance, in a medical scenario. But I do think that that's where the complexity comes in, is in the asymmetry an asynchronicity of information flow within that organization through the people's brains. And as people kind of are not on the bus of change, they then get left behind. And I guess that perhaps creates anxiety. And then that immunity that I mentioned, where people try to stop that change from happening. So that would be my gut feel on the idea. In terms of the changes that are happening now, I think that the rate of change is something to consider for us, because while the events that you mentioned were so groundbreaking and so different in their nature from what we're experiencing now, our ability to adapt to the change would seem to be easier now, because the severity of these incidents is so much lower than the ones you cited. But I do think that the capacity of our nervous systems to process the information that's coming at us right now is saturated. Whereas before, there was this one big event that was a colossal event. I think now the events are so rapid, and they change. The change is cognitively great. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. I kind of see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, you raised some really fascinating points. Tyler, what's your take?
What's coming to mind, actually, as you're talking about that, is this, at least in some of my martial arts training back a few years ago, was it's like when things are around you are changing really fast, there's a lot of change going on. On one level, there's a lot more background noise, right? You're trying to decipher what's really relevant change versus what things are just kind of happening that are just going to pass over quickly, move on without really having much of an effect. So there's something around there that I'm kind of interested in, that with all this change that's happening, constantly trying to adapt to every little change, you know, getting the new app every day or whatever it is, and it's going to be really difficult and cognitively challenging for you, versus thinking a little more long term and seeing how there's going to be a lot of background noise in this process of change over time.
So people always say, well, what is different then? So we had a lot of change 100 years ago. Yeah. Well, what is different? Connectivity is what's different. By virtue of the internet. So a boat travels maybe twice as fast as it did in 1910. They used to travel 30. Mm-hmm. Maybe they go 60 miles an hour now. But information travels, you know, millions, maybe billions of times faster. So that's so interesting. And, you know, there are all sorts of metaphysical theories about how the universe is actually composed of information, not of matter, and what's important in the universe is information and not the stuff. But so anyway, without getting all metaphysical, so that's our information thing. Now, what we have is this, our information flow. So there's an estimate that we are exposed to the equivalent of 174 newspapers a day of content, which is more than someone 100 years ago would read in a lifetime sometimes. So with all of that, there's a great quote from actually a 1960s economist, is a deluge of information creates a poverty of attention. And I just wish I'd said that, because what we have is we are absorbing megabytes and gigabytes of information on a daily basis. We're swimming in it. It's of sometimes indeterminate quality. But the second thing is it hits an information processor that moves about as fast as it did 10,000 years ago. So that is the sort of traffic jam, the biological and the organic end of information. And so a lot of what's important today is having, and a lot of the sort of data science revolution, the artificial intelligence revolution, is having a way of taking this deluge of data that we have and converting it into information, converting that into knowledge, and then converting that to actionable wisdom. And so that ordering of information from a deluge of data to information, which is structured, to knowledge, which is accessible, to wisdom, which creates the kind of knowledge that you can act upon, is really the sort of journey that we're on. So I hope that's not too abstract, but that's one thing. The connectivity and information flows are the things that I think are more are different than 100 years ago.
And it makes me wonder thoughts on you know, how can we handle that better? Do we need to augment ourselves in some capacity to be better at it, or you know, kind of offload some of this processing to technology?
Well, we're already augmented, that, aren't Adam? We're already cyborgs. Yes. I mean, most people are joined mm-hmm. to a technological device. If you were looking at Earth from above, you know, 25,000 feet or above the planet or something like that, you would see these machines interacting with these humans, but it wouldn't be clear to you, like, who's responding to which, like whether we're the organic end of this great big cybernetic network, or whether the cybernetic network is the kind of electrical end of these human organic organisms. And it wouldn't be clear from a distance who's doing what. Like, when my phone pings, I respond. When an email comes in, I respond. I'm, you know, don't like to live my life like this, but I'm responding a lot to a lot of technological prompts. So I think that's an interesting, so our phones are joined to us. And even though the phone isn't implanted, that's a small step from having it like permanent, like my teenager's phone is never out of his hand. Which I think is an amusing thing.
No, I think you bring up a good point. It's almost like we tend to think that we're not augmenting ourselves. We're not that connected to technology yet, and it's going to be more, but we're already there. And it's just going to change maybe in the future, but
how much bigger deal would it be if their phone was considerably smaller and it was implanted under your shoulder blade? Not that big a deal, right? I mean,
what are your thoughts on that, Adam? I know you work a lot in tech and augmented, I guess, augmented realities or augmented human tech brain interface.
Absolutely. So there are so many ideas that you guys just touched on there around, you know, all the way from so many great thoughts and threads that we could pick up and unpack. But back, you know, the one thing about this is around the same time as that quote which Paul mentioned came out, there's this other great quote that I think of by Alvin Toffler that was around the fact that coded information is seeking entry at faster and faster rates to our nervous systems. And that's absolutely what we're experiencing, what we're feeling as human beings. And the manifestation of the experience of this is through this rudimentary way that we interact with our devices at the moment, through our thumbs. Now, I imagine that future humans looking back on this will see this as quite a primitive way of interacting, in the same way as we see, you know, a caveman using tools as a primitive way of interacting with the environment. I love the idea of the base of the universe being information and you know, many of the things that Paul said really resonate with me in terms of this. I think that in terms of coping with this future, something interesting, Tyler, that you said was background noise. You know, this idea that not everything is so useful to us. Not everything is.
Oh, good God. That's for sure. I get 400 emails a day. I delete 350 of them unread.
How do we use these technologies to protect our headspace, to filter better, to allow us to preserve our state of mind? And I think at the moment, it's just kind of this flooding spray and pray mentality of information. Sure, we have selection algorithms, but the selection algorithms are either selecting from junk or we're dealing with being trapped in a junk nervous system because our nervous system seeks that dopamine kick when we see something that intrigues us. So yeah, there's so much to it. So there's so much to it now that going forward, looking at what we can do in terms of just what we allow our brains to see, there's so much that we can do there in terms of, without augmentation, in terms of improving the way that our headspace is.
You know, it's funny, our computer power doubles every 18 months, according to Moore's law, which is only now we're beginning to suspect that, although quantum computing is, by the way, coming around. So now a quantum computer, guys, if you want a little factoid, did something in 3 minutes that would take a traditional supercomputer 10,000 years to do. So when that stuff comes online, you know, your folks at Singularity may prove right. But anyway, without going into quantum computing, the signal to noise ratio is something that's really, I spend a lot of time thinking about. I started and haven't finished a book called Truth Wars, and a lot of the information we get is a variable quality. Take nutrition, for example. Take climate change, for example, take utterances by politicians, take public relations statements by corporations. There's a lot of disinformation out there. And so we're both deluged in information, and it's of variable quality. And what we haven't done is developed a sort of Moore's law for human beings. So with all of this taking place right now, how do we upskill ourselves? And there's not enough people thinking about, and there are some people, news literacy, science literacy, financial literacy. There's a sort of new sort of literacy movement that I've explored. But we need to upskill ourselves to live in this world, because we are changing, I think, more slowly than the technology. Our culture is catching up. There was a sociologist, I can't remember his name, he's in the book, someone, I think his name was Ogborn, talks about cultural lag is when the culture of a company or a society lags technology. You lead to all sorts of nasty dislocations. And I think we're in the middle of that. And we may have always, as human beings, been in the middle of something like that. But we're certainly in the middle of that. We haven't developed a Moore's law for human beings. We'll never forget to charge our phone, but we often forget to recharge ourselves. You know, the way of nurturing the organism so that we can retain our competitive advantage. So if machines are taking all of the cognitive drudgery away from us, well, what's left for us? What's distinctly human? Machines, I don't think, will ever, perhaps someone who's an expert on AI could tell, will never be visionary. They'll never say, analytically, oh, what we want to do is create a multi-planet species, and we want to colonize Mars, and we want to have a green revolution so that we no longer consume fossil fuels. That doesn't sound to me like something a machine will ever do, but we need to cultivate. We need to sort of need to, in economic terms, what's our competitive advantage? What's distinctly human? And how can we nurture and grow that so that we can play our role in, as you say, Adam, shaping the future, and not being, you know, passive victims of this technological change. Sorry, I went on for rather a long time. I apologize.
No, I love the point about the just how much low quality information we have. It makes it really, I think, a big challenge for us when it comes to ideas of change in the future. And then this other idea that I think Adam, we had talked about this previously, is this idea that, you know, you can have all this great technology come online, but if we're not upskilling our own, you know, brains to be able to make use of it, it's not going to be valuable to us.
And that's where this idea of augmentation can be very helpful to us. But this being out of sync with the pace of change in technology as human beings is an important point, because I think we're seeing a lot of manifestation in society of the consequences of that. We're seeing technologies being perhaps misused, technologies being treated, perhaps imposed on societies. So we're not necessarily seeing the very best that we can out of human beings with technology. So we've got a lot of upskilling to do there as well, in terms of how we're reacting to technology, how we're adopting it and using it in our lives.
Yeah, the government and governance aspect of this is just a really, really frightening and scary thing. So, you know, I'm a techno-optimist in terms of, I think technology will make the world a better place for human beings. It may even solve problems like disease and climate change. It may take us to another planet. It will certainly, I think, I'm very, very optimistic about that. But in the short term, you know, we are still reeling from the effects of the rapid globalization that took place in the 1990s. And it took 20 years to unfold. But the populist backlash was against the people who were left out. Yeah, the upper middle class, you know, of which I'm a member, thankfully, we got cheaper stuff from China. But meantime, you know, our brethren in the industrial United States were displaced by the millions by globalization. And we handled that very badly. We handled it a lot less well in the United States than they do in Europe. And the change that was in the 1990s is going to be a relatively, I think, trivial change, because what's happening with AI and robotics is, in fact, knowledge workers, the upper middle class, are going to have their jobs either changed or eliminated. And McKinsey, again, who I turn to because I think they're very good on some of this stuff in the World Economic Forum, as someone else is very good in it, think that 100 million jobs may be changed or lost. Well, a big recession is 10 million jobs. Think how much social dislocation that is. 100 million jobs. And that's an extraordinary thing. And so we're very poor as a society of doing that. And then also from a governance point of view and an ethics point of view, because we are so fast technologically and the people who regulate technology are so slow, you know, all the smart guys go to Stanford and open up a business in Silicon Valley. It's not to say there's no one smart at the FDA or the FCC or anything like that. But, you know, by and large, I think it's true that these very big brains fueled by the capital that a company like Google attracts can innovate much more quickly than society can keep up in terms of an oversight and governance and regulation. Mm-hmm. And that is worrying to me. It's worrying to me in human cloning. It's worrying to me in artificial intelligence. It's worrying to me in modification of the genome to creating new species. We can now create different kinds of DNA. So there are only four kinds of human base pairs in DNA. There are now four ATCG base pairs. So we're going to be able to create synthetic life from the DNA up. I mean, this is crazy stuff. And the good people who should be looking after our interests, the politicians, just aren't quick enough or perhaps not even smart enough to really protect the mass of humanity from some of these things which could go wrong.
There seems to be also this idea of divergence and convergence here too, where we could have for a while where only a certain people can take advantage of this stuff and it could harm others. And then at some point it gets back to the place where everybody benefits from it. I don't know if that's a possible, like what your thoughts on that are, or just thoughts in general.
Like a trickle down, like a technological trickle down to folks at the top. Yeah. Is that the sort of thing?
Yeah. I think that technology has this way of becoming more and more democratized over time. But initially there is this potential bifurcation or gap between people who have access to tech and people who don't. And the challenge that we face is the initial gap. You know, like in chaos theory, we have this massive sensitivity to initial conditions. And if we set the initial conditions that only few have access to something that's completely groundbreaking, that then the division and gap becomes so great that over time, it's impossible for even the democratization of technology to bridge that gap, because there is such a vast difference in, for instance, augmentation between people with access to that technology and people without it. So that is a major risk that we face. And I think if we're looking at a time when there is an exclusive access to technology and there is a great initial advancement that people have in terms of getting access to that, that does also set up another challenge for society. And if we think that the wealth gap now is massive, an augmentation gap could be orders of magnitude greater in social impact, importance, and economy. We do face some really interesting times. And I think that we have to be considering that because regulation is slow and tech is fast, and because innovation is happening at a much greater pace than society is able to keep up, and because we only know the secondary effects long after the technology has arrived.
The unintended consequences.
Yeah, I think the unintended consequences. We need to start thinking about using things like simulation, which, by the way, is I think an underutilized tool, and hopefully in the future we're going to be using it much more to look at projecting into the future and simulating out what the scenarios are, what the secondary effects and consequences are. And I think that attention in research needs to be going to that, because perhaps with better data on future effects, better data on secondary effects, we'd be able to do better as a species. And perhaps if we can use things like consensus technologies to decide how we want to use these technologies in our society, we can also start to be active participants. You know how you mentioned within a company, having people who have a view on the future and are accountable and responsible for it. As citizens, we've outsourced that. And that's such a tragedy of our society. Mm-hmm. We were outsourcing it to a very slow, cumbersome, and sometimes corrupt system.
We are, yeah.
So what I'd like to do to wrap up, though, is to just have you both share kind of your final thoughts that came from the conversation, or a final thought on, you know, how we can help leaders be more intelligent about the future. So, Paul, if you want to.
Well, I'm struck by how much shared language and shared perspective. And I've never spoken with either of you before, but yet we seem to be, I don't find myself in disagreeing with precious little. That's interesting. me, you know, we're either very wise or very self-deceived, all of us. I do want to leave it there. Those are my parting thoughts, if you will. I've really enjoyed the connection with Adam. Mm-hmm. Tyler, we've been talking about talking for 6 months or something like that. I'm a fan of your work. So yeah, I think I'll pass the talking stick.
All right, Adam.
Well, I mean, I echo the sentiments. This was a really interesting and fascinating conversation, and it's been great to connect with both of you guys. We've touched on so many aspects of tech and society and the interaction between the two in this brief conversation that there's so many threads that we could pull on to unpack. But in terms of helping to make leaders better suited for futures, both in their organizations and in our society, I think we've got to just fundamentally work on being better at being humans and look at what that really means in terms of treating each other better, getting each other better synced up in terms of change, respecting other people's need to be brought on when change is arising, and enabling people with the tools to better cope with change, be it enabling them with meditation, for instance. A company I used to work at, we got everyone licenses to a meditation app. And I just think that if we can do more of that fundamental human stuff and let all the drudgery be taken away by technology, like Paul mentioned, where menial tasks are going to disappear, I think we're going to start building toward a better future. And there's a lot more to say on this, of course. I don't want to make, you know, a last sweeping statement that everything is going to be great if we all just meditate. But I mean to say that
if we can get an app to do it for us, that'd be even better.
Yeah, outsource it to the cloud, absolutely. It's been great chatting to you guys.
May I add, if I could, I'm a leadership development guy, and so, you know, I don't get to have conversations like this nearly often enough. It's been wonderful. But one of the things that if I could wave a wand, that I would teach corporate leaders and political leaders, two things. Systems thinking, which came out in the 1960s and 70s, and Donella Meadows, and it still penetrated only the 0.01% of the executive community, and critical thinking, something which you learn in the humanities. And those are two skills, two meta skills that I, you know, if I could wave a wand, you know, and to help people make better decisions, that would be the leadership program that I would run, and I've run a lot. So that's my intelligent leadership kind of sentence, if you will.
No, perfect. It's funny because I taught critical thinking in college, and I remember the students, like the first day they'd be like, why are we even taking this course? And in my mind, I was like, this is the most important class you're going to ever take. It'll help you with everything in life. And it took them a while to get that. And so just final wrap up, what I'd like to do is ask you to give one word that you'd like to share that you think leaders should embody or embrace moving into the future. Adam, do you want to start?
One word. One word for leaders to embrace. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very tough question.
It's a tough question. You have it, Paul?
Yeah, I want them to think about the next quarter century and not the next quarter's earnings. So that's more than one word, but magic wand, that's what I'd like.
Okay, great. And Adam?
I would just say the term bandwidth.
Bandwidth.
I think we can use our measurements better and increase our bandwidth to have a broader scope on what's going on by measuring at different levels of abstraction and measuring different variables. So I think we need to look at the idea of bandwidth.
Perfect.
I don't mean the technological sense rather than the neurological sense.
Great. Paul and Adam, thank you so much for being on this Future Intelligent Leadership Flowcast. Really appreciate your time and insights.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you guys both so much.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs, or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more futures intelligent leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha.